I'm going to start by just reading this quote slowly. "And I have indeed given to you. Among what I have given you are two phrases from beneath my throne. There is no power and no strength saving God, and there is no refuge from you except unto you."
Wow. Yeah, there is no refuge from you except unto you. I mean, if we really, you know, if we just pause and sit with that second phrase for a minute.
It's staggering, right?
It is absolutely staggering because it represents this complete collapse of how you and I usually understand, well, the very architecture of safety and danger.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you wanted to start right there because I read that quote in our source materials today, and it honestly just stopped me in my tracks.
It sounds like a riddle, doesn't it?
Right. At first glance, it feels like a total riddle.
Yeah.
But let's unpack this for the listener because, you know, normally the concept of a refuge is a very simple, almost geometric idea. We deal with it every single day.
Basic survival instinct, really.
Exactly. There's a threat over there and there's a safe place over here. You flee from the danger toward the safety.
Right. The vectors, they point in entirely opposite directions.
Right. The two things have to point away from each other for the concept of a refuge to even make logical sense. I mean, you run away from the tornado and you run toward the storm cellar.
Or away from the wolf, toward the cabin.
Yes. But this phrase, which, by the way, the text explains, comes from the mirage, you know, the famous night journey of the Prophet Muhammad through the heavens. It completely collapses that geometry.
It breaks the whole model.
It really does.
Yeah.
It asks this profound question, like, what happens when the thing you are fleeing from is God? Where on earth, or I guess in heaven, do you go?
Because if God encompasses everything.
Right. If God is everywhere, the only place there is to flee to is also God. It's basically suggesting there is no exit from God that isn't just, you know, a deeper entrance into God.
Which, structurally speaking, is a total paradox.
Mm.
And what's really fascinating here is that within the narrative of the text, this isn't offered as just some clever piece of poetic wordplay. This is framed as a supreme cosmic gift because the prophet is asking for a distinguishing gift, you know, something on par with the great miracles given to earlier prophets.
Like Moses' staff turning into a snake. Or Jesus reviving the dead.
Exactly. Huge, visible miracles. And in response, God gives him this phrase, "There is no refuge from you except unto you."
Which feels, honestly, almost terrifying.
It does. And to understand why that is a gift, and not just, you know, a terrifying trap for a human being, we really have to look at the underlying reality it points to.
And the author of our text uses a really beautiful analogy here that I definitely want you to walk us through. It involves a wave and the ocean.
Oh, yeah. It's probably one of the most vivid images for this concept. So I want you, the listener, to picture a single wave on the surface of the sea.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Imagine that somehow this little wave gains consciousness and suddenly it becomes utterly terrified of the ocean.
Just looks around and panics.
Right. It looks down, realizes the ocean is vast, it's deep, it's dark, and it is entirely capable of completely absorbing it. Like, effectively ending its existence as an individual, distinct wave.
Which, I mean, if you're the wave, that's a pretty reasonable thing to be afraid of.
Oh, entirely reasonable from the wave's perspective. So, driven by this fear, the wave decides it has to run away. It summons all its kinetic energy to flee the ocean.
Go away.
But here is the problem. Where can it possibly run? How does a wave run from the ocean?
It can't.
Right, because wherever it runs as ocean and it runs into ocean. Every single movement it makes to try and escape is, well, it's physically constructed out of the very water it is trying to escape.
Wow, so it's literally trapped by its own composition.
Exactly. And eventually the exhaustion sets in, the realization hits, and the running just has to stop.
Because it's pointless.
Because the wave realizes the separation was an illusion to begin with. There is no wave that exists independently of the ocean. The threat and the refuge are the exact same substance.
That is just incredible. And honestly, it sounds like a really lovely piece of poetic philosophy at first glance. But the mission, you could say, of our deep dive today is to prove to you, the listener, that this is actually the most brutally practical instruction for carrying human fear.
It really is.
And for managing the crushing weight of being, you know, a small creature in a massive universe.
It is the ultimate practical tool, yes.
Which brings us to exactly what we are doing today. So welcome to this deep dive where we are continuing our ongoing journey into Islamic philosophy for everyday listeners.
Glad to be here.
Today we are exploring the writings of the great 20th century Iranian philosopher Allamah Tabatabai. Specifically, we have a short, incredibly dense appended essay of his titled The Tawhid of Islam and Its Fruit.
And it is just a remarkable piece of writing. But I think it's important to frame why Al-Alayemeh wrote this specific essay as an appendix to his larger philosophical works.
Right. Let's do a quick recap to ground us, because what we were talking about today is really the hinge of his whole worldview. In our previous discussions, we explored a claim from his work that honestly gives you a bit of vertigo. It's the idea that God is not just the largest, most powerful, oldest being in the universe.
Right. Not just a really big guy in the sky.
Yeah. God is not an item in existence alongside you, me, and the nearest galaxy. Rather, God is unbounded existence itself.
Mm-hmm.
Pure, unconditioned being that completely outruns every word or label we could possibly pin to him.
Yes. God isn't a noun you can easily categorize, you know.
Yeah.
God is the limitless ground of reality itself.
Which is a beautiful, mind-bending idea. But I read that, and my immediate cynical reaction is always like, okay, so what?
Well, so what is exactly the right question to ask?
Because ideas about God usually stay behind a glass display case. We admire them, theologians debate them, academics write papers about them.
But they don't change your life.
Right. They don't actually change anything about how I wake up, how I deal with a flat tire, or how I face a terrifying medical diagnosis. But there is that old saying, right?
Yeah.
A tree is known by its fruit. So the central question we are asking today is, what actually grows from taking this dizzying idea of God seriously in an ordinary Tuesday afternoon human life?
And that really is the ultimate test of any philosophy, isn't it? I mean, if a metaphysical concept doesn't cash out in your actual human experience, it is just mental gymnastics.
Just a puzzle.
Exactly. And Alayemeh is acutely aware of this critique. He knows the danger of getting lost in the clouds. The title of the larger book this essay belongs to is Treatises on Divine Unity.
Okay.
And this specific essay, focusing on the fruit, is basically his promissory note being cashed. He is explicitly saying to the reader, all of this abstract, complex reasoning we've done actually fruits in something very real, very tangible in your daily behavior.
Okay, but you said a moment ago that to understand the fruit, we first have to map the tree. And that tree is built around one central, highly specific Arabic word, tawheed.
Yes, tawheed. And I can't stress this enough. If you don't understand how Alayemeh uses this word, literally nothing else in the essay will make sense.
Well, I've always heard it translated simply as monotheism, or maybe divine unity, like just the belief that there is only one God, not two or three. Is it more complicated than that?
It is much, much more active than that. Literally, the root of the word means making one or declaring one.
Yep, making one.
And here is the critical distinction Alayemeh makes right at the beginning of his framework. He says, making one is a relational concept.
Wait, what do you mean by a relational concept?
It means you cannot just make one in a vacuum. You have to make something one. There has to be an object receiving the action.
Ah.
Because it is relational, its entire meaning shifts depending on what specific object you're unifying. Alayemeh says that in Islamic philosophy, there are three possible objects of tawhid: the essence, the name, and the act.
The essence, the name, and the act.
Right. And because there are three distinct objects, there are three distinct depths or degrees of understanding this oneness.
Okay, let's walk through this map carefully, because everything else we talk about today, all the practical daily life stuff we promise the listener, is going to stand on this framework.
It's the foundation, yeah.
So we have three depths of one. The first depth he mentions is essential tawhid, or in Arabic, dadi. Explain what essential tawhid means in plain terms.
Essential tawhid is the claim that every single thing in the universe, in its very being, stands by God right now.
Right now?
Yes. It is the absolute total rejection of the clockmaker universe.
The idea that God built the machine in the universe, wound the spring, and then just stepped back to let it run on its own.
Exactly. Essential tawhid says the dependency is not historical. It is continuous. It is entirely in the present tense.
Okay.
Your existence, right this very second as you listen to this, is leaning on God exactly the way a reflection in a mirror leans on the face standing in front of it.
Oh, that's a great image. Because if I'm standing in front of a mirror, my reflection is there. But if I turn my face away, the reflection doesn't fade out slowly over a few hours. It vanishes the exact millisecond I move.
Precisely. The reflection has absolutely no independent power to sustain itself in the glass. That is essential tawhid. The realization that things do not just get made and then left to exist independently, they are being continuously sustained, continuously held in existence.
That is a profound shift in perspective. I mean, it moves religion from God named me a long time ago to God is making me exist right now in this exact millisecond.
It makes it incredibly immediate.
Okay, so that is the first depth, essential tawhid. my very existence leans on him. What is the second depth?
The second depth is nominal tawhid. The Arabic term is asma'i.
Nominal, referring to names.
Yes, referring to the divine names. Now, in this philosophy, a name is defined as the divine essence taken together with some specific attribute.
Like what?
Like the merciful, the knowing, the living. So nominal tawhid is the claim that every genuine positive quality you can name in the universe, whether it's the fact that you are alive, the fact that you have knowledge, your capacity for power, or even, you know, the beauty of a sunset, is fundamentally God's quality, merely on loan to the creature.
Wait, I want to hit the brakes here and just push back on this, mm-hmm. because this is where my modern Western individualistic brain starts to seriously glitch.
It usually does for most people.
I understand the idea that God created me, but are you saying that my own aliveness isn't mine? Or that my ability to know things? I mean, I went to school, I read the books, I formed my own thoughts. Are you telling me my own intellect isn't actually mine? I'm just borrowing it.
Yes. That is exactly the radical level of dependence that nominal tawhid insists upon. You do not possess life as an independent property that belongs to you. The life animating your body right now is a lent life. The knowledge you possess is borrowed knowing. You are essentially a vessel holding something that does not originate from you, and more importantly, does not belong to you in any permanent independent sense.
Wow. Okay, that just strips the ego right down to the studs. Because it's one thing to say God gave me life, treating life like a birthday gift I now own and can put in my pocket.
Right, like it's your property now.
Yeah, but it's entirely different to say God is lending me life right this second. So essential tawhid means my basic existence is borrowed. Nominal tawhid means my specific qualities and attributes are borrowed. What is the third depth?
The third depth is active tawhid, or a folly. This is the claim that every real doing, every actual exercise of causation in the universe, ultimately traces back to and leans on God's act.
So even my actions aren't fully independent.
Correct. When you choose to type on a keyboard, or even when fire chooses to burn wood, the actual reality of that causation is an extension of divine action.
Okay, the author uses an analogy in the text to tie all three of these together, and I really want to spend some time luxuriating in it because it takes this incredibly abstract metaphysical map and makes it instantly intuitive. It's the analogy of a shaft of sunlight.
It is brilliant in its simplicity, honestly.
So to the listener, I want you to imagine you are sitting in a dusty, dimly lit room, and suddenly a single brilliant beam of sunlight falls through a crack in the window, landing right across the wooden floor. You can see the dust motes dancing in it.
A very peaceful image.
Right. Now, we can ask three questions about that shaft of light, and they correspond perfectly to our three depths of tawhid. First question. Does that beam of light exist on its own?
No, it doesn't. I mean, if you put a thick blanket over the window, cutting off the sun, that shaft of light vanishes immediately.
Instantly.
It cannot hold itself in existence for even a fraction of a second. Its very being is borrowed from the sun outside. And that illustrates the first depth, essential tawhid.
Exactly. Okay, second question. Is that beam of light bright with its own inherent brightness? Does it have a little battery inside it making it glow?
Again, no. It has no independent reservoir of illumination. The brightness you perceive in the room is entirely the sun's brightness, arriving in that specific space.
So the quality is loaned?
Yes. The quality of brightness is on loan. That illustrates the second depth, nominal tawhid.
Right. The quality belongs to the source, not the medium. And the third question, does that beam of light do anything like warm up the wooden floorboards or illuminate the dust motes by a power of its own?
No. Every bit of thermodynamic work it does, every bit of heat it transfers into the wood, is actually the sun working right there through the medium of the light beam. And that is active tawhid.
Existence, quality, act.
Right.
Three ways the exact same dependence shows itself. That is just masterful.
It really clarifies it.
And it's crucial for you, the listener, to keep this three-part map in your head. Because as Ali Emmett points out, this isn't just an essay structure. This essence, names, acts, division, is the structural map for his entire massive book on philosophy.
Yes, it is the blueprint of his worldview. After this introductory essay, he actually dedicates a whole treatise to the names and then another one to the acts.
So when Al Emmett poses a question midway through this text, he asks, which of these three degrees of tawhid is the highest? He isn't just throwing out a trivia question for his students.
Not at all.
He's pointing us to the ultimate summit of this entire philosophical system.
He is showing us the absolute peak of the mountain, and his answer to that question introduces one of the most conceptually fascinating and honestly terrifying ideas in the text.
Okay, what's his answer?
He states that the highest possible degree is essential tawhid, the tawhid of the bare essence. But the very moment he names the summit, he tells us something really bracing.
Which is this?
He says you can never actually get there. The summit is closed.
It is structurally impossible for a human being to stand there. Now, wait. Stop right there.
I know. It sounds counterintuitive.
Because if it's a philosophy about God, and he points to the absolute top of the mountain of understanding God, and then says, by the way, you can never go there. What is the point? Why can't we know God's essence? Is it just because God is too bright or too big for our tiny human brains?
It's much more profound than just God being, you know, too big for our brains.
Yeah.
L.A. Lama carefully walks us through the actual mechanics of epistemology.
Epistemology, so the study of how knowing actually works.
Exactly. He points out that to recognize something, and the Arabic term here is marifa, requires a relationship.
A relationship between what and what?
Between a knower and a known. Just think about it. If you know a tree, there has to be three elements. There's you, the subject, there's the tree, the object, and there is the conceptual bridge between you, which is the act of knowing.
Right.
The tree has bounds, it has edges and characteristics that your mind can basically grasp and map out.
All right, I see. It's green-leaved, it's brown bark, it's height. My mind builds a model of it.
Exactly. But as we established when we defined the bare essence of God earlier, God outruns all relations. God is unbounded existence itself.
Pure being.
Pure being has no edges. It has no boundaries. It is prior to any categorization you could possibly invent. Therefore, at the level of the bare essence, there is no subject and object. There is no division.
So what you're saying is, it's not that my mind is too weak to grasp the object, is that there is no object there to be grasped in the first place.
Precisely. There is literally nothing for your act of knowing to hook onto. It's like trying to grab empty space with a pair of tweezers. It's a category error.
Wow.
The act of knowing requires a boundary to trace, and the essence has no boundaries. The text quotes a verse from the Quran that states this with absolute finality. I'll read it slowly. No one comprehends him in knowledge.
No one comprehends him in knowledge. So it's an absolute epistemological limit built into the fabric of reality. But if that's true, let me ask a really practical question. What are people doing when they sit down in a mosque or a church or just in their living room to pray or meditate?
That's the logical next question.
Right, because if they are contemplating God and they feel deeply moved, what are they actually touching? If the summit is closed, what are they experiencing?
It's a wonderful question. Al-Imam would say they are engaging with nominal tawhid. They are knowing one of God's names.
Oh, the names.
Right. They are contemplating the essence plus some attribute that they can relate to. They are experiencing God as the merciful, God as the forgiving, God as the provider. Those attributes are real and they form a real bridge. But the worshiper is never, ever laying hold of the naked essence itself.
To help us visualize this limit, the text introduces another analogy, and I have to say it's one of my absolute favorites in all of Islamic literature. It's the analogy of the bull in the sea.
Oh, it's a classic.
The tradition has this ancient saying that recognition is proportionate to the capacity of the recognizer. And Al-Imam expands on this. He says, imagine a bowl being filled from the water of the sea. The bowl seeks the sea, but it receives no more than its own capacity holds.
It perfectly captures the dynamic. When you lower a wooden bowl into the ocean, what does it fill up with? It fills up with genuine seawater.
Right. It doesn't get fake water. It doesn't get a simulation of the ocean.
Exactly. It gets the real thing.
Okay.
But it only gets a bowl's worth. And crucially, once the water is inside the bowl, the water takes on the shape of the bowl.
Yes. Let's expand on this because this is where it really hits home for the listener. Think about you and me as the vessels. Maybe my spiritual and intellectual capacity is just a tiny little porcelain teacup.
Sure.
And maybe the capacity of a great mystic or a philosopher or a prophet is a massive 1,000-gallon industrial vat. When we both seek God, both the teacup and the vat are being dipped into the exact same infinite ocean.
We are both getting 100% genuine water.
Exactly. But the ocean itself remains completely uncontained. It overflows every vessel.
It does. And the tragedy of the human ego is that we constantly look in the water inside our specific bowl and we say, ah, I have captured the ocean. The ocean is exactly this shape and it is exactly this deep.
We mistake the limits of our perception for the limits of reality. every single time we think we're looking at the vastness of God's essence, what we are really looking at is just the shape of our own bowl.
We are looking at our own cognitive limits.
Yes.
The sea is always the sea, unbounded, unheld. Alay Mez essentially saying that even the Prophet Muhammad, who might have the largest, most expansive bowl in human existence, still operates with a bowl. Even that vessel does not encapsulate the infinite essence.
Okay, but this raises a massive contradiction, or at least a paradox, that I really need you to resolve.
Okay, lay on me.
If essential tawhid, the oneness of this bare, unbounded essence, is the stage we can never actually reach, why on earth does Alay Mez insist on calling it the highest summit?
Ah, I see what you mean.
Right, because in normal language, highest usually implies the ultimate achievement, the thing you finally grasp at the end of the journey.
It does in conventional terms, yes. We think of the summit as the place we finally plant our flag and take a picture. But L.A. Mez's answer here is incredibly elegant, and it requires a total reversal of how we think about intellectual achievement.
How so?
He argues that the height of this summit isn't measured by how much knowledge you manage to pack into your bowl. It is measured by how much it negates.
Negates. Wait, what do you mean? What is it negating?
As you climb this philosophical mountain of understanding God, your journey is mostly about stripping away false ideas. It's a process of subtraction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Like stripping away the idea that God is an old man with a beard sitting on a cloud.
Exactly. You strip away the idea that God has a physical body. Then you strip away the idea that God is located in a specific place in space.
Because God is everywhere.
Right. Then you strip away the idea that God experiences time the way we do. You keep negating limitations. But when you reach the absolute peak essential tawhid, you have to strip away all rounds, all qualifications entirely. You negate every possible determination.
That sounds exhausting.
And the final, most dizzying step of this negation is that it refuses to even let the concept of oneness sit on God as a descriptive feature.
Wait. Are you saying that at the highest level of tawhid, which literally means making one, it negates the concept of tawhid itself?
Yes. It negates the determination of tawhid as a category you can apply from the outside.
Mind blown.
Think about it. To say God is a one in a descriptive mathematical sense is still to apply a human concept, human relation, to the essence. It's still a bowl.
Oh, I see.
Essential tawhid is the highest summit because it releases God from every single conceptual box we have, including our highest, most sacred theological boxes.
It's the ultimate intellectual humility. You climb to the very top of the mountain of theology, and the final realization is that your theology cannot hold God. You just let go of the need to capture the infinite.
Precisely.
Alay Mez seals this entire section of the essay with a fragment from the Quran, and the specific wording he chooses is vital. Let me quote it slowly. And that to your Lord is the final end.
I want to emphasize that last word, the final end. Not the final being, not the final thing you find waiting for you at the top of the mountain.
The climbing stops because there is simply no more up. You haven't reached the plateau where you can say, I conquered the mystery of God. You've just reached the absolute boundary of what it means to be a finite creature.
And this profound, humbling realization really sets the stage perfectly for where Alay Mez takes the essay next. Because having mapped the mountain, he now turns to look at how humanity has historically tried to claim it.
Right.
And he makes a very bold historical claim here that might actually surprise some readers.
I found this section fascinating because he is this towering Orthodox Islamic scholar. But he looks at this magnificent philosophical achievement we've just discussed, the realization that God is the necessary being containing all perfections. And he explicitly says, Islam did not invent this.
He is remarkably generous and historically expansive here. We really should present this exactly as L.A. Mez offers it, as his considered philosophical reading of human history.
Yeah.
He says this high conception of God is the common inheritance of humanity. He points to the ancient sages of Egypt, to the philosophers of Greece, to the thinkers of ancient Persia.
Basically everyone.
Right. He says that throughout history, rigorous minds have climbed this mountain and reached this peak, which the philosophical tradition calls Wahidiyya.
Wahidiyya. So he's actively validating the theological summits of other civilizations. To understand exactly what this peak of Wahidiyya looks like, you mentioned in your notes that we should look at another famous Islamic philosopher who predates Alay Mez, a man named Mulla Sadra. Why him?
Because Mulla Sadra, who lived in the 17th century, provided perhaps the most refined, crystalline version of this common human summit. He articulated a doctrine that became incredibly foundational for later thinkers like Alay Mez. The doctrine is called Tashkik al-Wujud.
Tashkik al-Wujud. which translates roughly to graded existence.
Yes, or the modulation of being. It is a dense concept, but Ah El Aimeh quotes Mulla Sadra directly in the text to summarize it.
Let's read Sadra's quote. And listener, take a breath, because this is pure 17th century philosophy, but we are going to break it down.
We will.
Sadra writes, "Existence is a single graded reality whose levels differ in intensity and weakness. Its weakest level is prime matter. Its strongest and most intense level is the necessary existence, unlimited in power and perfection. All these levels are real. Yet, in comparison with the highest level, their existence is relational and non-independent. They are obliterated and extinguished in the light and radiance of the necessary existence."
It is a stunning passage. Really beautiful.
It is.
But to make sense of what graded existence actually means without getting lost in the jargon, we can use an analogy that Sadra himself loved. It's the analogy of a single graded light.
Okay, set the scene for me.
I want you to picture three things. First, a small flickering wax candle. Next to it, a bright modern LED household light bulb. And finally, shining down from above them both, the blinding, overwhelming noon sun.
Okay, I have the candle, the bulb, and the sun in my mind.
Philosophically speaking, if we abstract away their physical containers, there is no difference in kind among those three things.
Right.
They aren't made of three fundamentally different substances. They're all simply light. The only difference between the candle, the bulb, and the sun is their intensity. They exist on a single sliding scale of illumination.
So Mulla Sadra is arguing that existence itself works exactly like that.
Yes. He is saying that everything in the universe, from a rock to a blade of grass to a human being to an angel, sits on one single sliding scale of being. At the absolute dimmest, weakest end of the scale, barely clinging to reality, you have what he calls prime matter, just raw, almost nothing potential. And at the absolute brightest end, blazing with infinite intensity and absolutely no ceiling, is the necessary existence. God.
So we all just different intensities of the exact same reality.
Exactly. And here is the sharpest, most radical edge of Sadra's doctrine, which Ah El Aimeh highlights in that quote. Think back to the light analogy.
Okay.
If you take that small wax candle and you hold it up against the blazing noon sun, what happens to the candle's light?
You can't see it anymore. It's completely washed out.
Right. The dimmer instances of light on this scale, the candle, the bulb, us, have no independent brightness that can compete. In Sadra's words, they are extinguished in the radiance of the source. Their existence is real, but it is entirely relational. It is obliterated by the sheer intensity of the necessary existence.
That is an incredibly majestic philosophical peak.
Yeah.
I mean, to realize that your very existence is just a dim candle held up against the infinite sun, that is a massive intellectual achievement.
It really is.
But this brings us to a really fascinating pivot in the essay. Because if the ancient Greeks, the Egyptians, the Persians, and brilliant philosophers like Sadra all reached this incredible summit of Wahidiyya, what is Islam's specific, unique contribution? Ah El Aimeh isn't just writing this to say, hey, everyone was right all along, is he? He claims Islam takes a step past this summit.
He does. And this is where his thought becomes highly original. He claims that establishing the most perfect degree of tawhid step beyond this graded scale of Wahidiyya into something called tawhid itlaqi, which means absolute unconditioned tawhid, is the singular defining feature of Islam.
Okay.
He associates this specific realization with what he calls the Muhammadan station.
So what does that step past the summit actually look like? Because if the ancient summit says God is the necessary being, the one who gathers all perfections at the top of the scale, how do you go beyond that?
You go beyond it by realizing the trap we talked about earlier. The phrase, the one who gathers all perfections, is still a description. It is still a concept. It is still a bowl. The step past the philosophical summit is the move from worshiping that highest concept to surrendering to the reality that outruns even the concept of perfection.
Wait, let me make sure I'm hearing you right.
Because
this is a subtle but massive shift for the listener to grasp.
Mm-hmm.
El Aimeh is not saying the ancient Greeks or Persians had a bad idea of God and Islam came along with a better, shinier idea of God.
Not at all, no.
He is saying that Islam's specific contribution is the complete release of the idea itself. It's the witnessing that God overflows even our highest, most flawless, most perfectly relevant philosophical conception of him.
You have it exactly. It is the difference between building the most magnificent, conceptually perfect cathedral of thought to house God and stepping outside the cathedral, looking up and realizing the sky can never be housed.
Wow.
The ultimate contribution is not a better idea. It is the liberation from the confinement of ideas entirely.
Okay. I need to take a breath, and the listener probably does too. We have just climbed an incredibly steep, highly abstract metaphysical mountain.
We really have.
I mean, we've talked about epistemology, graded existence, unconditioned realities, and extinguishing candles in the sun. And honestly, it sounds like you need a PhD in advanced medieval philosophy and decades of free time to read heavy books just to get a glimpse of God, which feels incredibly exclusionary.
It does sound like a purely elite pursuit, doesn't it? But this is exactly where Alele turns a sharp corner in the essay. He moves from the dense history of philosophy straight into the beating heart of every ordinary human being.
Okay.
Because he argues that you do not, in fact, need the PhD.
Which is a huge relief. So how are normal people supposed to reach this summit if they don't have time to read Mulasadra?
Alele argues that this ultimate summit, this essential tohid that philosophers spend lifetimes straining to articulate, isn't actually reached by dense logical inference. You don't logic your way to the top.
Then how do you get there?
Instead, it is grasped by a simple, innate witnessing. The Arabic term he uses is shuhud. He claims that you, the listener, and every human being on earth were born already holding this reality. You hold it via your iftirah.
Fitirah. I've heard that term used a lot in Islamic contexts. It usually gets translated as something like the primordial nature or the innate disposition. I like to think of it as the factory settings of the human soul.
Factory settings is an excellent modern analogy. It's the baseline operating system you arrive with before society, culture, or formal education install any additional software.
But how does he prove that? I mean, how does he prove that we innately know this unconditioned infinite reality from birth? Most babies seem pretty focused on food and sleep, not unbounded metaphysics.
Well, he uses an argument that is very quick, but profoundly deep. He asks you to start by looking at your own existence. Consider how you know that you are alive right now. You do not deduce your own existence logically.
Right. I don't wake up in the morning, look at my hands, run a logical syllogism like Descartes, I think, therefore I am, and then finally conclude, ah, yes, I exist.
Exactly. You apprehend your existence immediately, directly, and pre-logically through your very self. It's a felt reality before it is ever a thought. Now, L.A. Mass says, folded into that very immediate pre-logical act of perception is something you probably never noticed. He argues that you cannot perceive any bounded, limited, determinate thing, including your own limited self, without implicitly, simultaneously perceiving the unbounded background against which it sits.
Oh, wow.
Let me give you his exact quote. The witnessing of the determinate is nothing other than the witnessing of the absolute.
The witnessing of the determinate is nothing other than the witnessing of the absolute. Okay, let's use the analogy of figure and background, like you'd find in visual art or gestalt psychology, because that really unlocks this quote for me.
Go ahead, lay it out.
Think about how seeing actually works physically. You never see a shape floating in an absolute featureless void. If I draw a black circle on a piece of white paper, you see the bounded figure of the circle. But you only see it because it is set against the unbounded background of the white paper.
Exactly.
If you take away the background, the figure disappears. The bounded edge of the circle is, simultaneously, an announcement of the field it is cut out of. You can't see an edge without seeing what's beyond the edge.
It's a perfect illustration of his point. So apply that visual reality to your entire existence. Every single time you perceive a limited, finite thing, your coffee cup sitting on the desk, the ticking of a clock measuring out finite time, or even the finite edge of your own ego and your own patience. You are, without even consciously realizing it, already brushing up against the limitless.
Wow.
The unbounded reality of God isn't a complex math problem you have to solve at the end of a long philosophical proof. It is the paper the math problem is written on. It is the ground every perception has been standing on your entire life.
That is just beautiful. It totally reframes the spiritual search. The infinite isn't a million miles away hiding behind a cloud. It is the very condition required for us to see the finite things right in front of us.
Yes.
And Al-Elame says that from this one innate factory setting seed in our fitirah, three specific things naturally unfold. What are they?
The first, as we have just been discussing, is essential tawhid. It is the built-in innate recognition that every limited thing leans on an unlimited reality. That's the baseline.
Okay, so the first unfolding is the recognition of God. Does that mean the work is done? Because if I look around the world, simply knowing that an infinite background exists doesn't seem to automatically make people act any better or live more peaceful lives.
And that is exactly why the fitirah doesn't stop at mere recognition. The second thing that unfolds from the seed is absolute walaheet.
Walaheet, yeah. Define that for us.
In this context, Wal-Icha is the innate urge, the built-in spiritual reflex, that we owe this unlimited reality our surrender, our love, and our humility.
Oh, I see.
It is the natural human inclination that the only proper, sane response to encountering the absolute is to bow to it, to align yourself with it.
So knowing God leads naturally to the urge to surrender to God. What is the third unfolding?
The third is universal prophethood.
Wait, I understand how recognizing the infinite is innate. I even understand how the urge to bow to it is innate. But how can the concept of prophethood, which usually involves specific historical figures delivering specific books, be innate?
Because Alemat isn't talking about knowing the specific names of prophets at birth. He is talking about a structural hunger built into the human soul.
A structural hunger.
Yes. He argues that while we possess a basic moral compass, we intuitively know that justice is generally good and cruelty is generally bad. We also inherently know that our internal compass is easily skewed by our egos.
That's definitely true.
We have a built-in awareness that the specific details of our moral obligations, the actual map of how to live in alignment with the absolute, must be communicated to us from the outside. We have an innate hunger for guidance. We recognize that we need a map drawn by someone who can actually see the whole territory.
So, to summarize the human condition according to this text, the human soul comes preloaded from the factory with the recognition of the infinite, the urge to surrender to it, and the need for a guide to walk toward it.
Yes. And Alemat anchors this philosophical argument firmly in the sacred texts. He quotes the famous Fativer verse from the Quran, which is chapter 30, verse 30.
Okay.
I'll read the translation. So set your face toward religion as a Hanif the Fitra of God upon which he has fashioned humankind. There is no altering God's creation.
And he doesn't just stick to the Quran, right?
Yeah.
He brings in the Hadith literature, the collected sayings of the Prophet and the Imams, to show how they pinned this exact sprawling philosophical concept to a single word.
Yes. He cites a famous tradition where Imam al-Sadiq is asked what the word Fitra in that specific Quranic verse actually means. And the Imam answers with one single word. It is Tawheed.
But there is a second fuller report that Alemat cites right after that from Imam al-Bakir, which expands that single word into the entire foundational confession of the Shia Islamic tradition.
Let's hear it.
The quote says, "It is, there is no God but God. Muhammad is the messenger of God. Ali is the commander of the faithful. To here extends Tawheed."
This is a really crucial point for understanding the specific Imami Shia perspective of the author. In this view, Wa'ala'icha, which here explicitly includes the recognition of the spiritual authority of Imam Ali and the subsequent Imams as the designated guides, is not an extra layer of political or theological doctrine slapped on top of human nature at a later historical date.
Okay.
It is part of the original Fitra. It is right there in the initial seed of human consciousness, inextricably linked with the oneness of God and the message of the prophet.
I really want to dwell on the deeply humane, incredibly liberating takeaway here. Because if you view religion purely from the outside, or if you had a bad experience with rigid religious structures, religion often looks like an alien code of conduct being dropped on your head from outer space.
With an imposition.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It feels like an artificial program designed to overwrite your personality, suppress your natural desires, and force you into an uncomfortable, unnatural shape. But this framework says the exact opposite. Religion doesn't replace your nature, it completes your nature.
It is the articulation of what you already, at your deepest, quietest level, desperately want.
Yes. There is a quote from the Prophet Muhammad that fits perfectly here. "I have been sent to perfect the noble traits of character." He doesn't say, "I've been sent to introduce foreign alien traits you've never heard of." He says he has come to perfect the traits that your fitra already recognizes as noble.
That's a beautiful connection.
And there's another Quranic verse Alemat cites about the Prophet, noting that his function is to make lawful for them the wholesome things and forbid them the impure. The sacred law isn't an arbitrary test of obedience. It is just making explicit what your innate sensibility already inclines toward or recoils from when it's functioning properly.
Which means the entire edifice of religion, according to Alemat, turns on those three innate axes, Tawheed, Walaka, and Prophethood. Nothing is arbitrary. It is all a process of remembering, of uncovering what is already there beneath the noise of daily life.
Okay. We know the conceptual roots of the tree essential Tawheed. We know the soil it grows in, our own innate fitra. Now, finally, we reach the harvest.
The fruit.
The title of the essay is The Tawheed of Islam and Its Fruit. We've done the heavy lifting. What does all this soaring, cosmic, mind-bending philosophy actually do to my behavior on a random Tuesday?
Well, Ah, LAMS says the fruit manifests in two specific fields, our inner dispositions, meaning our character, and our daily acts. Let's start with character, because his argument here is genuinely startling, and it completely flips how we usually think about morality and being a good person.
How so? Walk me through his logic.
Usually, we think of virtue as a fight. It's a struggle of willpower. You have a vice, let's say, anger or greed or jealousy, and you use your willpower to wrestle it to the ground.
Right.
You white knuckle your way to being a good person by suppressing your bad urges. But Ali Aimee argues that a person who has truly internalized Tawhid, someone who genuinely sees that God is the only independent reality, doesn't fight their vices at all.
Wait, they don't fight them. Do they just give in to them?
No, they don't have to fight them because the Tawhid entirely removes the ground the vices grow in.
It pulls the floor out from under them. Okay, explain how that works mechanically, because that sounds almost too good to be true.
He points out that every single human vice, if you examine its mechanics closely, secretly requires a second.
A second.
Yes. It requires the illusion of something real standing alongside God for the vice to be about. If you remove the reality of that second thing, the vice physically cannot exist.
Okay, let's put this to the test. Let's walk through his list of specific vices and see how the floor falls out. Let's take self-conceit or vanity.
Self-conceit requires a self that is set up beside God. It requires a self that you believe is impressive, brilliant, and independent on its own account.
Right.
But if nominal Tawhid is true, your self is just borrowed existence. Your brilliance is a borrowed sunbeam. There is literally nothing independent to be conceited about. The ego has nothing to stand on.
Okay, what about arrogance? Arrogance feels a little different than just vanity.
Well, arrogance requires other people whom you believe are positioned below you in a hierarchy. But if everyone you meet is equally just a shaft of borrowed light from the exact same sun, the hierarchy dissolves. You cannot be arrogant towards someone who is sustained by the exact same life force you are borrowing.
What about ostentation or doing things just for show? I think the Arabic term he uses is riya.
Riya requires an audience. It is a performance meant to impress other humans, but if you truly see nothing but God, the theater is completely empty.
Oh, wow.
There are no independent onlookers whose opinions have any real weight or power to grant you status. Why perform for shadows?
What about miserliness, greed, the fear of losing my stuff?
Miserliness requires goods, money, or resources that are independently yours to clutch, defend, and hoard. But again, nominal Tawhid says you own absolutely nothing.
Not a single thing.
You are merely a temporary steward of borrowed qualities and borrowed materials. You can't hoard what was never yours to begin with.
This is so incredibly powerful. Once you take Tawhid seriously, once you actually believe it, rather than just reciting it, the second dissolves. The independent self, the judgmental audience, the hoarded wealth, they all dissolve into the borrowed shadows they always were.
The soil for the vice simply dries up.
You aren't fighting temptation anymore because the thing tempting you has lost its reality.
Exactly. And what is left in its wake isn't that gritted teeth, exhausted virtue of someone constantly fighting their own nature. It is a natural, effortless virtue that requires no props. It is courage and generosity that stand on nothing but God.
Unshakable.
LAMA gives this specific state a name in the text. He says, quote, "The noble traits come to be realized by God and for God." The phrase in Arabic is bil Allah la lilallah.
By God and for God. We have an analogy from the notes to help unpack this, the dried up ledger analogy, and I think it makes this crystal clear.
Let's walk through it.
Let's imagine two people who are both outwardly very generous. Let's say person A gives $1,000 to a local charity. They do an objectively good thing. But somewhere in the back of their mind, they are keeping a private moral ledger. They are registering a credit. I am a generous person.
Even if they don't tell anyone.
Exactly. Even if they don't post about it on social media, even if they never tell a single soul, they are still performing for the theater of their own ego.
Yes. They are accruing moral capital for an independent self. They are basically saying, look at how well my independent self is behaving.
Right. Now imagine person B. Person B gives the exact same $1,000 to the exact same charity.
Yeah.
But person B keeps absolutely no ledger whatsoever.
Why?
Because person B has internalized Tawhid. They realize there is no second party to accrue credit to. The wealth they gave was God's. The inclination in their heart to give it was God's. The recipient who receives it is sustained by God.
It's a closed loop.
Exactly. The giving just passes through them like water passing through a pipe on its way from God and back to God. On the outside, looking at the bank statements, the act looks identical. But on the inside, it is an utterly different universe. That dried-up ledger, that complete lack of self-congratulation, is the true fruit of Tawheed.
It is absolute freedom from the exhausting weight of the self. And Al-Alaima illustrates this psychological freedom most vividly when he tackles one final universal vice, the vice of fear.
Oh, this part is amazing.
He outlines three completely different ways a human being can try to overcome fear, and he ranks them from least effective to most effective.
I love this part of the text because it is so deeply relatable. Let's lay all three out and explore why the lower ones fail us. What is the first way?
I'll start with what he considers the lowest rung of the ladder, the philosopher's way. The philosopher tries to overcome fear by arguing with it, by proving that it is mathematically or logically irrational. They say, the thing you are dreading, let's say, losing your job or a bad medical diagnosis, is merely a possibility. It might happen, but it might not. To be afraid right now is to favor the negative outcome without sufficient logical evidence, which is an intellectual defect.
Okay, intellectually sound. But as Al-Alaima dryly implies, that is incredibly cold comfort. I mean, let's put this in a real scenario. It's 3 a.m. The ceiling fan is spinning. You are staring at the ceiling in a cold sweat because you were waiting for the results of a biopsy, or you don't know how you're going to make payroll tomorrow.
Logic isn't going to help.
Not at all. The philosopher is standing at the foot of your bed saying, statistically, there is only a 5% chance of ruin, so your panic is a logical fallacy, does absolutely nothing to stop the biological panic. Your body is in fight or flight. Logic cannot command the nervous system. It doesn't work. So what is the second way?
The second way is the ordinary religious way. This is what the vast majority of us do when we are terrified. You face a threat and you pray to God to remove it. Please, God, cure this illness. Please, God, protect my job. Please, God, don't let the storm hit my house.
Which is a perfectly valid human response, and religions encourage prayer.
Of course.
But notice what is happening structurally in the mind of the person praying. You are still treating the threat, the illness, the poverty, the storm, as a genuine independent adversary. You are essentially saying, God, there is a monster in the room. It is real. It has power. And I am weak. Please come fight the monster for me. You are affirming the independent reality of the second.
Precisely. You are keeping the fear alive by acknowledging its power, even as you ask for rescue. Which brings us to the highest level, the true fruit, the Tawheed way.
How does that work?
The person operating at this level doesn't argue with the fear logically like the philosopher, and they don't even ask God to remove the threat like the ordinary believer. Instead, they simply stop attending to anything other than God.
Just ignore it.
They realize in their bones that the threat has no independent existence, no inherent power of its own, no independent budget to harm them outside of God's direct will. They dissolve the fear by dissolving its object entirely.
And here we are, full circle.
Yeah.
We loop right back to our cold open. This is exactly what the phrase from the Mirage means. There is no refuge from you except unto you.
There he is.
That one phrase is the Tawheed way of facing fear, compressed into a single breathtaking sentence. It's not a magical incantation to get God to fight your earthly battles. It is the profound, world-altering realization that there is no danger out there with a standing of its own.
Right.
The monster in the room is just a shadow cast by the only light there is. The wave finally stops fleeing the ocean because it realizes it is ocean. The threat and the refuge are one.
The fear is met and utterly consumed by Tawheed. This is the first harvest, the total transformation of the inner character. But Al-Alaima doesn't stop in the mind or the heart. There is a second harvest, which is the field of our daily physical acts.
Right. Because even if you achieve this zen-like state of fearlessness, you still have to wake up and chop wood and carry water. You have to commute to work, raise kids, do the laundry, pay taxes. How does this massive concept of Tawheed actually change the mundane, repetitive tasks of a Tuesday afternoon?
He claims that Islam takes this intense, unifying divine orientation and extends it to literally everything. It is not a state of mind reserved for the prayer mat or the mosque or the pilgrimage.
Okay.
You attach a quiet internal for God to eating your breakfast, to sleeping, to trading in the market, to washing your hands, to navigating sickness and health. You do this until the entirety of a scattered human life is woven into a single, continuous fabric of worship.
Let me quote Al-Alaima exactly here, because the phrasing he uses is paradoxical, but it's vital to get right. He says this orientation continues, quote, until it became a way that preserves Tawheed in the very midst of multiplicity and preserves this multiplicity in the very diversity of its members within Tawheed.
That is a dense sentence. We need to hold both halves of that thought. preserves Tawhid in the midst of multiplicity. What does that mean to you in practical terms?
Well, to me, it means a unified life isn't a blank, monotonous sameness. You don't prove your devotion by going to sit in a cave, staring at a blank wall and chanting one, one, one for 50 years while ignoring the world.
Right.
The thousands scattered multiple acts of the day, answering emails, chopping onions for dinner, talking to your neighbor. They stay distinct.
Yeah.
The diversity of life is real. And it is explicitly preserved. Let's use the analogy of the notes of a melody to explain this.
Yes, I think that fits perfectly.
If you sit at a piano and press middle C over and over and over again, that's not a melody. That's just an annoying, monotonous noise. A melody requires multiplicity. It requires many different notes, high and low, short and long, quiet and loud.
Right, the variety makes the song.
Exactly. The multiplicity is essential for the beauty. But what makes it a song, rather than just a random pile of chaotic sounds, is the single melodic line that runs through all of them, connecting them, giving them a unified direction and purpose.
Beautiful.
In a life of Tawhid, your daily tasks are the notes. They stay diverse. But your quiet intention, bil la, walil la, by God and for God, is the melodic line that turns the noise of your life into a single, beautiful tune pointing toward the infinite.
It is a life that remains gloriously various, deeply engaged with the mud and mess of the physical world, yet utterly singular in its motion. It is a stunning, holistic vision of human potential. And Alema ends this entire essay with an impassioned oath that we should really let land with the weight it deserves.
I'll read his closing oath. Quote, yep. So count this a treasure, for by God, this is a blessing not equaled by the seven mighty heavens, the cradling earth, and the mountains, set as pegs.
And before we close out today, I think we absolutely have to share the human detail behind the creation of this text, because it anchors everything we've talked about in reality.
Yes. This is my favorite part.
Eli Alema wrote this soaring, cosmic, mind-bending essay about the furthest reaches of epistemology and theology in the early months of 1938. Now, where was he when you wrote it? He wasn't sitting in a grand, comfortable university chair. He wasn't yet the famous, revered, untouchable teacher in Qom with thousands of students.
He was working as a farmer. He was back in his family's village near Tabriz, doing manual, exhausting agricultural labor just to survive and feed his family.
Exactly.
He was a working farmer, sweating in the dirt fields all day, who would go home at night by lamplight and write these incredibly dense, luminous pages on the deepest spiritual fruit a human life can bear. To me, that biographical detail just proves his exact point. The multiplicity and the dirt of the physical world don't distract from the unity of God. They are the very place you enact it.
It is the perfect lived embodiment of his own philosophy.
Okay, let's bring it all together. Let's synthesize this journey we've been on for you, the listener. In our previous deep dive, we talked about the doctrine, the massive conceptual tree, God as pure, unbounded existence. Today, we looked at the fruit.
We did.
And the message El Elay May leads us with is uncompromising. If that reality of God is true, it was never meant to be a fun philosophical fact. You file away in your brain to sound smart at dinner parties.
Right?
If you really see it, it quietly and inevitably pulls the floor out from under your vanity, your grasping, and your fear. It leaves you with a courage and an honesty that stand on nothing but God. If you learn all the vocabulary of Tawhid, but you remain just as frightened of the future, just as vain about your accomplishments, and just as greedy with your resources as you were before, that you haven't actually believed the doctrine. You've only categorized it. The fruit is the only true test of the tree.
It is a profound, demanding challenge to all of us.
And it sets us up perfectly for our next deep dive. Next time, we are opening the second treatise of this massive book, The Names. Because if, as we learned today, we can never actually reach the summit of the bare essence, then the names are where we actually live with him.
Exactly.
We will explore the 99 faces of one undivided reality, and we'll dive into the secret of the greatest name. As it turns out, the bull has a lot to learn about the shape of the sea.
Before we go, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over as you go about the rest of your day. We talked about how every time you witness a bounded thing, you are actually implicitly witnessing the unbounded background holding it up.
The figure in the background.
Right. So what happens to your daily routine if you start actively looking for the edges? When you see the edge of your coffee cup this morning, or when you feel the very finite edge of your own patience later today during a frustrating conversation, try to feel the limitless background it is resting against. What does your day look like when you realize the unlimited has been holding you up the entire time?
There is no refuge from you except unto you.